punctuated by the lighter's bright jaws snapping shut. "One thing," Case said, and drew on his cigarette. He blew the smoke up at the touring registry agent. "Do you guys have any real jurisdiction out here? I mean, shouldn't you have the Freeside security team in on this party?" He saw the dark eyes harden in the lean boy face and tensed for the blow, but Pierre only shrugged. "It doesn't matter," Roland said. "You will come with us. We are at home with situations of legal ambiguity. The treaties under which our arm of the registry operates grant us a great deal of flexibility, and we create flexibility in situations where it is required." "You are worse than a fool," Michelle said, getting to her feet, the pistol in her hand. "You have no care for your species. For thousands of years, men dreamed of pacts with demons. Only now are such things possible. And what would you be paid with? What would your price be for aiding this thing to free itself and grow?" There was a knowing weariness in her young voice that no 19-year-old could have mustered. "You will dress now. You will come with us. Otherwise, we kill you. Now." She raised the pistol, a smooth black Walther with an integral silencer. "I'm dressing already," he said, stumbling toward the bed. His legs were still numb, clumsy. He fumbled with a clean T-shirt. "We have a ship standing by," she said. "We'll erase Polly's construct with a pulse weapon." "Since Nettle be pissed," Case said, thinking, "and all the evidence in the Hosaka. They are in some difficulty already for having owned such a thing." Case pulled the shirt over his head. He saw the shuriken on the bed, lifeless metal, his star. He felt for the anger. It was gone. Time to give in, to roll with it. He thought of the toxin sacks. "Here comes the meat," he muttered. In the elevator to the meadow.
And coming up next on Free Radio, it is indeed Bathrop's Pierce Broadside, the August 19, 2009 edition. Stay tuned for 2 hours of thrill-packed fun.
Down so fucking
And those were some old 90s songs from the, I'm not sure if they're disbanded or just in temporary retirement, the Just Kiddin' Band. That's with Phil Free and Skidmark Bob and Spirit and others. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, or Freak Radio as well, at www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris. This is, of course, Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, 2 hours of lots of interviews on the street, my commentary on a number of local issues. Who knows? Maybe your phone calls. The call-in number here is 427-3772, 427-3772. I've invited critics and admirers alike to call into this show, the big issue that I've been talking about a lot on the streets for decades, it seems, is decriminalization of homeless people and poor people in public places. And that's kind of archetypically represented by the sleeping ban as the most obvious and most blatant violation of basic rights for poor people. The law in Santa Cruz under the camping ordinance that criminalizes people who sleep after 11 o'clock at night in a city which is, according to the Homeless Service Center director Doug Loisel himself, has zero walk-in shelter, emergency shelter available. Maybe when there was fires going on, the Red Cross had some special shelter set aside for those lucky enough to actually have homes and be temporarily displaced from them. And maybe a few homeless people got in there who were displaced from their camping areas out in the firelands, because I imagine some of that happened too, and though you don't hear anything about it, there's been no public concern about their safety or welfare that I'm aware of, at least not in any kind of clear way from the mainstream media or even alternative media. But generally speaking, and pretty much as a straight blanket statement, there's no shelter tonight for people, and there's a law that makes it a $97 crime to fall asleep at night. So on Saturday, day after tomorrow, we will be resuming protests downtown, we being HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, a group I work with, to encourage people to shop at stores that give a shit or that care at least around the issue to the extent that they support the idea, even the very idea, that homeless folks should have the right to sleep not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere. And we've encouraged people to put a little kind of placard in their window saying that they support this. And we're also going to be in front of a business which has made it their business, at least in the past, and also signed a declaration that has increased the penalties and the threat for two homeless musicians in particular, Ana Richardson and Miguel de Leon, that if they fall asleep, not only do they face a $97 fine if they fall asleep downtown on public property, they face jail, immediate jail. So you might say, well, you know, it's great, three hots and a cot, right? Well, not exactly. You get jailed in Santa Cruz. They take your property. Sometimes you don't get it back for the weekend. They let you out at 3 in the morning. It's not an attempt to provide you with accommodations. And even if it were, it's a very, very expensive deal, both for the person who is being incarcerated and also for the rest of us who are paying for it. It's really kind of ridiculous. So we'll be there at noon in front of Lulu Carpenter's. That's a cafe down at the end of Pacific Avenue, or at the beginning, depending on which side you're looking from, near the town clock. Lulu Carpenter's is a coffee shop, kind of an upscale coffee shop. It's been notorious at different points in the past because its owner, Manthri Srinath, has gone out of his way to dress down and abuse homeless people, patrons, even his own staff on different occasions. And, in fact, I will be playing during this show kind of a replay of testimony we got from former employees about not just his behavior in terms of how he's treating the workers there, which certainly is significant and an issue to be considered, but how he treats homeless-looking people and how he directs homeless-looking people who are trying to spend money, not begging, you know, but trying to spend money, who show up at the coffee shop. Now, this is more of an investigatory tabling we're going to be doing. We're trying to get some testimony from folks on the street as to what's been happening, because while we've gotten anecdotal information about Manthri Srinath's behavior. That's the owner, Manthri. The various ringers we've sent in have not been discriminated against, although we're not sure whether it was because they didn't look homeless enough. They didn't see any homeless people in there, which may be good or may be bad. They kind of, it's upscale coffee house, so it kind of is slightly more expensive than other places. If you go online, you'll find that Srinath prides himself on personally sampling his coffee at the beginning of the day. And, you know, I mean, he's a, you know, it's a sort of a coffee connoisseur's place. And I've got nothing against that for all of you who can afford to do that and who like to do that. And, you know, that's fine. The question has to do with how are homeless people being treated generally downtown? And what Srinath did do is he filled out a declaration which was used by the city attorney to make it a crime, a jailing crime, for sleeping outside. And I don't think Srinath asked for that. I don't even know if he supports the sleeping ban. In fact, we're trying to get some more information. And Manthri, if you're listening in, or any of your customers are listening in, you want to call in and you have some information, I'd love to hear it. 427-3772. But this was a declaration that denounced one of the two musicians, Anna Richardson, for taking five paper napkins, according to my recollection of reading this declaration 4 months ago. And it didn't result in a stay-away order from Lulu Carpenters. It didn't result in a prosecution. According to the declaration, Manthri Srinath complained the police themselves didn't want to take it as a complaint. It was so trivial and so petty, but they did anyway. But our real purpose here is to send a message to businesses downtown that if you're going to actively discriminate against homeless people and be a part of the Downtown Association's sleeping ban, pro-sleeping ban policies, and we've recently asked them to discuss it, and they're not interested. They've told us we're not going to come because we don't like your protests, which is interesting. I mean, that's probably the surest way to make us protest more. If you're going to be having these discriminatory positions on such issues as the right of homeless people to use public spaces or to engage in survival behavior, or even if you want to maintain a kind of, we see people discriminating, but we don't give a damn position, we're going to encourage the public to patronize businesses that do give a damn and to avoid those that don't. And really, it's a pretty simple thing. It's not necessarily one that's going to win us any friends. We get a lot of flack. Huff members do. I personally, if you go online and you want to read more about this, you can on Indie Media. Santa Cruz Indie Media, www.indiebay.org, IndieYBAY.org/Santa Cruz. And you can read about the protests that have been gone for 9 weeks at Bunny's Shoes. And there's some interesting video and some interesting debates come up. And the merchants kind of show the iron fist under the velvet glove by calling the police and trying to move us along. Not because we're disturbing the peace or anything of that sort, but because they don't like the message we're putting out, and they want it gone from their store, particularly if it's their store that is being criticized for its policies. Now, you would have thought that the First Amendment in Santa Cruz guarantees the right to engage in such criticisms, but laws were passed at the behest of the merchants and conservative staffers on city council and city council members in 2003 under Matthews and Rotkin. Interestingly enough, they're back again. Rotkin is vice mayor. Matthews is the mayor at the moment. Which makes it illegal to have a table for more than an hour downtown, a political table for more than an hour in a particular place. So the police come, they tell us to move, and we say no, and we argue about it, and a crowd gathers, and we make speeches. And it's all sort of theatrical, but it's relevant because this is not just a crackdown on homeless people, but a crackdown on First Amendment activity. You may have some thoughts about this. Feel free to call in. 427-3772 is the number to call, and we'll be talking about this more. What I'm going to do first, I think, is to finish up City Council's last summer session discussion of medical marijuana dispensaries and a six-month moratorium, which it unanimously voted to impose. In spite of the fact that there was no emergency, no problems that were shown, no huge rush of applications that was documented, just some anecdotally referred to, two people who were up for opening up medical marijuana clubs if they could pass through the rather rigorous process of examination through the zoning commissions, or is it the planning commission? I'm never sure which. Their hearings that were coming up. And through the labyrinthine and very restrictive law that was passed by City Council in 2000 that really severely limits where you can open a marijuana distribution center, a sales center, a club, where you can sell marijuana to people who are patients. And no doubt some people who are not, but who have patient cards, as if that makes a should be a major concern to people. I mean, if people are spending huge amounts of money on really real toxins like alcohol and tobacco, and then people start raising the roof and closing down marijuana instead of regulating those other outlets, it's really kind of interesting and shows to me a very peculiar set of priorities. But, you know, this is something that most listeners, it's like we're talking in second grade terms. We know marijuana is far less dangerous a substance recreationally and medically than these other substances, and for that matter, than all the pharmaceuticals that are dumped into people both to regulate their mental states and also even for physical conditions. It's it has to do a lot, I think, with profiteering, and it has to do a lot with funding police departments who are actually whose major money-making enterprise in many cases is, you know, going after drug busts, even though it's an unending, endless cycle that never stops, and it cannot be solved through prohibition. Of course, what we have here now is the Santa Cruz City Council from late July coming up with this proposal that this, first they had previously, they'd said 45 days they were going to do a moratorium. Then, a month and a half later, at this meeting that we're going to be listening to, they immediately voted they wanted to expand it because the staff wants it expanded. Do they ask the staff really what the emergency is? Well, even though it's a really interesting emergency, it's a very serious emergency requirement. There's no emergency actually shown by the staff, but the law itself requires 6 out of 7 votes of the city council member, a 4/5 vote. It essentially almost required a unanimous vote, since I think there are only 6 city council members there. And so any city council member who had the guts to say, wait a minute, they don't need a moratorium. We already have a process in place. We have people applying to open medical marijuana dispensaries, 2 of them. They've already paid their landlords. They've already set up their whole situation. They've already paid their fees. Let's let it go through the usual process. No. This was the staff didn't want to do this. Instead, it wanted a complete freeze on all applications. And also the applications of the current 2 clubs that are open for growing marijuana on their premises so they could provide more cost-effective supply of marijuana, more product to people who are either in need of it or desire it. And I actually got a letter email from Elizabeth Limbach, I think her name is, I may have pronunciation wrong, from the Good Times, who's writing an article, or said she was writing an article on this. And an article did come out which really covered none of these issues, which she didn't write. And I wrote her back sort of a brief summary of the 10 points I came up with just sort of off the cuff, which really outraged me about this whole process. And I've talked about them in a previous show, but just very briefly, the obvious issue is the lack of marijuana supply in this area. So that issue was one that was not addressed, except in the vaguest terms by Rotkin, who I think said, well, we have 1 club for every 25,000 people, that's enough. Or every 2,500 patients, that's enough, which I don't know where he gets that figure from. I guess it was what was being done in San Francisco, where there are a variety of clubs. It may be true that in San Francisco you have, I don't know, 800,000 people and 30 clubs or something, 30 or 40 clubs, and that works out to 1 per 25,000 people. You can go to any one of 30 clubs. In Santa Cruz, you can go to 1 of 2 clubs, or you have to go to San Francisco, or you have to go find your way to someone that D.A. Bob Lee may be prosecuting for selling marijuana to you, even if you have a card, such as Roger Minch at the Hemporium in Felton. So the lack of supply was an issue I raised. Then it just seemed to me, given the lack of any kind of real showing of an emergency to change the laws and to suspend all these applications, that this was a reefer madness mentality. They were talking about, they were demonizing marijuana. There are existing protections that slow down this process. Anybody can appeal. Neighbors can appeal the decision of the zoning commission if they want. So it can be a relatively long process. It took months for Lisa Milano to open her club back in 2005, and it took a special variance for her to do that. There were no real stats presented about the crime problem. In fact, they claimed they acknowledged there was no crime problem. I noted also that, and you'll hear this as the first speaker is going to be Lisa Milano talking about this issue. Lisa is the owner and co-founder of Greenway, which was the first medical marijuana club to open legally in Santa Cruz after the city shut down all the other clubs through the restrictive 2000 ordinance that was passed way back then and shut down Kate Wells Club and a couple other clubs that were trying to open up, kind of similar to the process that's happening now. We're going to hear Lisa Milano talking, and she and these other applicants make no arguments or concerns based on the general principle about what's the emergency. What's about a fair process for everyone? It's more, I have my application in. I have my club. Let me open my grow room. Let me get my application processed. They ignored the costs to the applicants, like the landlord, the security costs. They ignored the benefits of having a marijuana club in the area where you actually will be providing more security. They ignored the concerns that the applicants pointed out, that having a club open or having a club go through the current process would be a way of testing the current ordinance in terms of whether it was operational, in terms of how a neighborhood regards that club, in terms of what the planning commission or the zoning commission's concerns are, the public works concerns are. And it ignored the historical reality of what a similar moratorium in 2000 did, as I've mentioned before. These are the changes that cut out attorney Kate Wells, who was also running a medical marijuana club, and ran one of the first clubs over on Maple Street that was actually in operational when it was still illegal, and it was tolerated. Ironically, it was easier to get it when it was illegal than when it was legal. The feds have not backed off from their raids. I think that we've heard about raids in the last couple of days. The DEA actually was raiding out in Corralitos. I got a special email from Tim Rumford, who announced that on a nearby and a neighboring farm, the DEA was out there busting marijuana. And so the DEA has not stopped raiding either clubs or marijuana fields and grows. And that was the main reason that they said, oh, we have a whole bunch of applications, and there's going to be all these people rushing in to try to open up marijuana clubs because the feds have stopped raiding. Well, the feds haven't stopped raiding. And there's also the reality of our own DA Bob Lee, who created a very bad precedent in People versus Mensch when he went after Roger Mensch for the Hemporium. And the California Supreme Court found that for a retail establishment to be legal, it has to be either a collective or a cooperative, which means it can't be a business, which means 95% of all the collectives and cooperatives in California are technically illegal, which is ridiculous because the state authorities, so they're harassing small people like Roger Mensch and going after small growers. They are not going after established businesses in cities where they're already established, probably because it would be too embarrassing to do that. It's a pretty clear contravention of Proposition 215, SB 420, the enabling law for Proposition 215. But that is, in fact, the actual technical law, that you've got to have a collective or a cooperative to be able to provide marijuana to somebody else, and they have to be a member of that collective and cooperative. So I suppose you could cook up some deal where everybody who walks in the door becomes a member of the collective or cooperative, like I think Dennis Perrone, the pioneer freedom fighter around marijuana in San Francisco, did, essentially the seminal voice behind Proposition 215 statewide in 1996. But So you have all these factors which make it hard for people to get access to something that they shouldn't have to sneak around, and they shouldn't have to sell in black market areas, that they shouldn't be prosecuted for selling or possessing, but that continues to be a blank check for police to harass. And continuing this sort of mythology that it's a dangerous drug is what the city council is doing. And it's, Mike Rotkin, the great liberal, the pot-smoking liberal. I don't know. I'm told he smokes pot. I don't know if he does. He's our vice mayor. He's an instructor up at UCSC. At least I think until he's laid off, or he was laid off, but he wasn't laid off yet. I don't know what his story is. It's pretty outrageous. Anyway, let's hear some of the testimony of Lisa Melino. And again, sadly enough, when she comes in, she doesn't talk about the principles involved, about the right of people to have access to an adequate supply, the right of there to be competition in this market so people can actually do it, her own deficiencies in not providing really low-income marijuana or income to marijuana to low-income people. But instead, she just talks about the needs of her club. It's all about my needs. It's all, sadly, a kind of this me, business mentality. And you saw it in the other two applicants, or you heard it if you listened to the last show that I did, which was on Sunday. You can go back and listen to that in archives. These shows are archived at Huff, H-U-F-F, SantaCruz.org, in case you want to hear them.
Good afternoon, Mayor, City Council member, and staff. You know me, I'm Lisa Molino, the owner of Greenway Compassionate Relief. I come to you today to ask that the reference to grow houses be taken out of the moratorium. I know that you've gotten your opinion, but as I read the ordinance, you have to be a dispensary already to apply for the permit. And that has siting criteria that's pretty strict as it is. Our goal would be to be able to supply at least half of our medicine for our patients. We have a huge compassion program that we pay for. It equals about 3 pounds a week. And as things start going economically, a lot of our local vendors are going other places, like L.A., where they can get $2,000 a pound more. And they've told me, I'm losing my house, I have to go there. So our supply has been affected. We've had to reach more, pay more. We haven't cut back on our compassion program or raised our prices, but those are the directions we go if we can't supply at least half of our supply. So we went to put in for our permit just about a week before the moratorium, and I knew it was coming. But I started searching how could we, move past the two dispensaries that exist. I propose growing in our space. It's in another space in our building. It's not the same space, which is easier for us to secure. And I think that this council is behind most of the dispensaries that are here. So I'm asking that you remove that so that we can continue forward with our permit and continue to supply our community. Because it actually comes down to a sustainability, as the DEA takes out growers too. So we see the effect constantly. This model that we use doesn't work. We need to start growing some more for ourselves
to
stay sustainable. Thank you.
Okay, is there anyone else who wanted to speak to this issue? Then we'll close the public testimony and bring it back. Mike.
So my question is both to the legal staff.
This is Mike Rotkin, and you're going to see him now make a feeble attempt, as I mentioned when we heard the earlier part of this tape on Sunday, to exempt and remove grow rooms from the moratorium so that Lisa Molino could have her grow room and perhaps Ken Sampson could have his grow room. Those are the two people who have marijuana clubs currently open in Santa Cruz, but nobody else could.
Assistant City Attorney Angela Planning, I don't know who the appropriate answer. If what I want to do is allow each existing dispensary to have one production house and be look at the questions that were asked in the that we're going to study more broadly in the moratorium in the long term. This is a short-term issue, that would be affected by what we end up with at the end of the moratorium, possibly, but in the interim, that it only be for attached to existing dispensaries, that the parking requirement be as low as it can be for a commercial use because the customers don't come to the grow facility. They only come to the dispensary, so you only need parking for the employees. That the security, the police department should determine what additional security measures are necessary, if any. And yes, the production house in the interim period that we're talking about should be, and this could all be done through a special use permit hearing at some point.
Well, it has to be.
I don't understand. That's
okay.
Fine.
So you can't say you're allowing it because they're allowed to apply for a special
exactly.
use permit.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's all they're allowed to do is apply. But that's what I'm going to try and do is say that take out the exemption in the moratorium that says they can't even get to a hearing for a special use permit. Can I do that?
And that cranky, loud voice you hear off to the side is the staff member. I'm not sure. Is it Mark Dettel? I don't think so. I think it's somebody else. Chris Schneider, perhaps, who is, pushing this six-month moratorium through. The real powerhouse is the staff in the city, and in spite of the fact that it's the council members who get elected, or perhaps because of that fact. And you hear Rotkin saying, he's acknowledging you're going to need this special use permit hearing anyway. There is an elaborate selection process, a winnowing process is going to be happening, so why not remove, at least allow current clubs to have grow rooms and grow their marijuana? They haven't had any problems, in the past, although I don't know that they actually have their grow rooms at present. I think they're trying to expand it to allow that, but they have a problem with the supply, which, of course, is the reason new clubs want to open up. Of course, Rotkin doesn't even consider that as a possibility. He wants to sit around and wait till one of the staff agencies comes up with new, more restrictive rules. Although, why they need new, more restrictive rules, given these elaborate minefield regulations they have to go through already, is not clear. In fact, it's clear that they don't. They need less restrictive rules. That's been our concern for the last 9 years since that 2000 set of rules was put into effect. We've only had two clubs opening up.
The statute allowing a moratorium provides is that in order to impose it or extend it, you're finding that there's a threat to the public health, safety, or welfare, and that the approval of a production house or a dispensary would result in threat to the public health, safety, or welfare.
And so the finding we're going to make is about additional, because we didn't make the finding for the existing dispensaries. The finding we're doing is for additional, and so the issue here would be the same. In other words, the findings would be if we were to have additional production beyond the serving the two existing facilities, that raises all those concerns which we want to study through our moratorium process. I mean, I don't think we're playing games here. I think there is a serious reason to study, which we'll talk about probably in our comments, but to study further what the long-term impact to our community would be of having additional facilities, proliferation of them, even more than two.
He asserts this, but he provides no indication of what those concerns are, or no police stats, or no problems from other cities even, just the vague, flat assertion that somehow allowing these two applicants, the two new applicants whose applications have come in and who tried to set up clubs, even letting them have a hearing is a threat to the public health, safety, and welfare. This is clearly preposterous. And Rotkin is making it sound like it's simple fact.
And although I personally think probably there's room for more than two, but what that number is, I don't know. And that's why we want to do a study and look at this in a serious way. So if we end up simply striking the language that references in this document, that references the production houses, and make orally to you the findings which we'd have you write down and include, which is we exactly the same findings for additional uses out there in the community, is that something that passes a legal test and wouldn't undermine the strength of our moratorium? Is the question.
If the council could find, if the council...
By the way, I have no idea if anybody even agrees
with
me. Right.
No, I'm just saying the council could find that... there is the threat that justifies the moratorium on the dispensary and the public dispensary, and then if the council thought that that threat, that exempting the current dispensaries from having a production house fell within, you know, outside of that threat justifying the moratorium, the council could make that finding.
Well, go ahead.
And I would want to clarify the number per existing dispensary, too.
Okay.
And again, we might change it after the moratorium. We study this issue further. We might decide to change that, but I'm looking for some relief in the interim period here.
Don.
A couple of questions. One,
it's Councilmember Don Lane.
If could the council, I'm not quite sure who I'm asking this to, but could we in direct staff to come back with a revision in a shorter period than 10 and a half months?
Right.
And if we were to do so, what would be a reasonable amount of time?
I'm thinking it's going to be 4 to 5, but, you know, you never know what's going to happen. But if you wanted to say 6, that probably would be safe.
Okay. And then the other is, it came up that the fees were non-refundable. If the two applicants in this situation, do we have the ability to refund their fees? If
yes. I mean, normally we there's a portion that we can give the majority of the fees back normally, and if the council wants to do more, that's to the council's discretion. But we have done some processing on it prior to the moratorium, but I don't know why it was ever said that none of the fees were refundable.
So, Don Lane, again, we used to call him Gone Lame when he was mayor 20 years ago. He comes in with this, well, gee, let's only have a 6-month moratorium instead of a 10-month moratorium, and we'll refund the fees to the planning that the applicants had to pay. But who's going to refund the deposits they had to put down on the property? And where's the actual demand that there be a real showing of current threat to the public health, safety, or welfare from these applications? It's not present. And Lane, they're all ignoring the elephant in the room, which is the fact that the planning department is making an absurd allegation, which everybody is just nodding and saying, yes, sir, three bags full to, that there is a public health, safety, and welfare threat that requires this emergency moratorium. And that's what it is. It's not like done by a council majority. It's done by, as I was saying, a 4/5 majority. 6 out of the 7 votes have to be there. And since there are only 6 people, I think it has to be 6 out of the 6 votes.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm ready to try.
Then, are there any other questions? Okay.
Well, I'll move that we direct staff to create a 7-month moratorium. A little extra month there just for safety's sake. That we make the findings necessary to prohibit, as we've done, as suggested, based on what's already suggested to us by staff, for having this moratorium in general, that we find that if there's only one production house per existing dispensary, that the concerns are alleviated in terms of what the impacts might be to the community. Therefore, the findings don't apply to one production house per existing dispensary, and that... And I think that's all I need to do in the motion. I think that's the motion. I will add a comment afterwards about, which may be helpful to the staff in terms of approaching the zoning board if and when someone brings a application for a special use permit. But I don't think that's part of this motion on this moratorium.
Second. We got a motion and a second. Comments?
Well, could I ask if he'd be willing to enter to add an amendment related to the refunding of the fees? Is that interesting?
Yeah. I'll add that they should be 100%. If we now place a moratorium and we've stopped them in their tracks, if they want their money, and they may decide to keep the fee in because it puts them in a particular position after the moratorium's unloaded, but should they want it back, my motion includes 100% refunding of the fees for these two projects that we've just, through no fault of their own, we have killed dead for the interim at least. They have the right to keep the them in and not ask for it back. That's up to them.
Can I clarify that? We're talking about refunding fees if they choose to withdraw at this time.
Right,
if they choose to
motion.
Keep their application active during this time, the fees would stay.
Right. Did you have a brief question about the fee issue? You might should come up and use the microphone. We need to have it on the record.
Okay.
Well, if it's brief, and I mean not as opposed to an argument or something, but please come up.
I'll argue with you.
I'm sure you would like that.
I would.
And I think this is one of the applicants who's coming up to speak about, I think his name is maybe Steve, I'm not sure.
You're out of order.
Mike, that's your warning?
That's all you're saying.
Anyway, I'll make the, sorry for the second, I'm happy to make a total refund. I think when you put a moratorium on people and you tell them you've invested in something and now we're at least for almost a year going to stop it, I think it's only reasonable that we refund their money.
I'm okay with that as a second. I have a question about that.
Hello? Yes, my question is this. I'm not sure her name. You had mentioned that there's going to be in order for it to proceed, for the moratorium to proceed further as far as extension, even the moratorium itself, there has to be some type of safety concerns. So as I haven't seen the report from Alex, as far as are there any safety concerns to the public right now? Because if there are no safety concerns, meaning that the two active applicants or even other applications were to have any safety threats to the public or community, then this is not valid. It just doesn't make sense.
And this, of course, is the point I've been making. There's no safety concerns. This is simply reefer madness stuff. The preference of the staff maybe not to work on the issue now. I don't know. Behind-the-scenes conservative police pressure, it's not clear what the hell is going on here, but it is clear that even this motion made by Rodkin Mullis, and it's about 10 months, and we have a six-month moratorium, let's refund the fees, although it's not going to help them pay for the landlord and stuff that was brought up to me, that the amount of rent they've had to pay, the deposits they've had to put down. Now, they aren't bringing this up to the city council, unfortunately, and they don't. I think maybe they found some way of working it out with the landlord. Maybe they weren't giving me the whole picture. Maybe they're embarrassed about seeming to be engaging in special overturn my money pleadings. Well, what's really also absent here, as I mentioned at the beginning of this whole discussion, is what about the need? What about the need of people for marijuana? And that's probably one of the reasons this thing rammed through so quickly. It was on an afternoon session. It didn't get much publicity. People thought it was going to come back in September. There was already a 45-day moratorium over the summer, and it would have been longer than that because you wouldn't really have a hearing until city council resumes probably in the fall. A use permit hearing for these two applicants if the 45-day moratorium expired in August or in early September. But they came back, the staffers that wanted this moratorium extended to 10 months came back at this afternoon session and pushed it through. And we don't have Valerie Corral. We don't have other medical marijuana patients. I think the only person who spoke against it who was a medical marijuana patient was Craig Canada. And he only got 2 minutes to speak against it. There's no medical marijuana patients union here, as there is, let's say, in Mendocino or up north. And so we have really a very weak advocacy group that doesn't really exist except when it comes together on radio shows like this one with Anita Henry and Craig Cannon, who comes sometimes speak on the air about this. Andrea Tischler of the Compassion Flower Inn is gone. People like Theodora Carey were not there to speak up. It's because some people are, they're burned out. They did their work. They struggled in the 90s to get Proposition 215 passed, earlier before that to get Proposition A, the Santa Cruz County advisory measure okaying medical marijuana passed. And now we have the behind the scenes or now even out front destruction or obstruction of access to marijuana and no discussion of the supply problem. Because if there weren't a supply problem, there would not be any real motivation for people to open up new clubs anyway. So obviously there's a supply problem. Huff is going to be, when we're tabling downtown day after tomorrow talking about issues of criminalization of the poor downtown and laws that criminalize the poor like the sleeping ban, We're also going to be talking about and encouraging people to give us information and input, not only in discrimination by businesses, such as it's claimed Lulu Carpenters has been discriminating and other businesses, but also are people able to get their medicine, their medication, marijuana? Can a poor person get a marijuana card in this county these days? I'm hearing mixed stories. Can they get access to marijuana cheaply without risking getting hauled away by the police for buying on Pacific Avenue, you know? We're going to be looking into all these issues sort of peripherally. And if you have any input on them, please come on down to the table. That's in front of Lulu Carpenter's 12 to 2 on Saturday. I'll be there. No doubt the police will be there as well, keeping an eye on everything and telling us to move on. We'll have to have somebody else set up a second table because of the absurd laws that the city has put into practice. We hope to get some information about what's going on and to raise the issue again. Again, you're listening to the Santa Cruz City Council's late July, last hearing of the summer on essentially a slam-dunk staff amendment that went through that. It was slightly modified. I think it was turned into a six-month moratorium, which returned the fees to these two applicants, but denies the whole community access to the services they might have provided. And again, you had just heard one of the applicants say, "Where is the public health and safety and welfare emergency? Please show it to us."
Mike can respond to that.
Council,
yeah. Okay, yeah, so that question is, as far as the safety goes, is there... What is unsafe as far as the two active applicants?
We'll respond to that in comment.
Thanks. My response to that comment is that in general we don't know what the long term safety concerns are. That's why we're doing a moratorium. If we knew what they were, we might decide just to pass a law saying only two facilities. At this point, I think that, and I'll save making my comments later.
That is no answer. If you have a legislation that specifically requires an overwhelming majority and you need to show an emergency, you don't say, well, there might be an emergency. That's why we're going to have a moratorium to figure out if there's an emergency. No, no, no. That is preposterous, except that nobody challenges it, except, of course, the applicants.
One of the reasons that I felt we needed a moratorium is there are not a lot of facilities in Northern California. I understand there's a legal one in Redwood City. There's several in Oakland, which is a city 10 times our size. None of the other cities in the county have one. Nobody had this one, apparently by rumor, one illegal facility over in San Jose, but, or at least quasi-illegal, but nothing actually legal in the way of a dispensary. And so I think we want to study the question. I don't know the answer to it. But
so the answer here seems to be, the opposite. I would draw the opposite conclusion. Since there is such a benighted attitude throughout the state allowing dispensaries to open, shouldn't Santa Cruz show some sense in this matter? Shouldn't they allow access? And since it's harder throughout for Santa Cruz people to get the medical marijuana they need, isn't it even an important issue only for our own community? And for those who come to Santa Cruz to buy marijuana, it's a revenue-generating activity that could be taxed and regulated, and that, of course, has been the objective of numerous organizations seeking to decriminalize marijuana bills in the state legislature from legislator Tom Ammiano, and it's all these arguments are being turned on their head as though they made sense to say, well, you see, because nobody else does it, that means we shouldn't do it either. We should think about it a long time because all these other people are bigoted or fearful. Ruled by entrenched interests that have prejudices against marijuana. It's hard to believe that this kind of discussion goes on in the so-called progressive Santa Cruz City Council in 2009.
We want to become the medical marijuana dispensary for most of Northern California is a serious question for us.
And that, of course, is an absurd exaggeration since there are a dozen or so clubs up in San Francisco. It's certainly easier for people in San Francisco to buy up there, but it's not easier for people in Santa Cruz to get up to San Francisco.
And
the safety impacts of that question are not, you know, that anybody's going to get high on marijuana and go kill somebody. I don't think that's what the record shows. But the whole issue of distribution of a drug that the federal government considers illegal and the traffic that follows from that and how what happens to it following is something we don't understand the impact of. I think we know the impact of two facilities. It's apparently safe. We haven't had problems. There's no complaints. But an unrestricted number of additional facilities or even one additional beyond what we have now is a question we need to do more study before we know the answer. And I know that's not pleasing you, but that's the findings that we're making up here.
It's not just it doesn't please the applicants. It does not meet the requirements of the law to show there is a health, safety, or welfare emergency. It just doesn't.
I'd just like to add that it's health, safety, or welfare.
Okay, so comments.
Yeah, well, I want to comment and segue right now because basically just what you just stated, Mike, is why I want to keep my interest is in keeping the moratorium very clean, which doesn't allow an exemption for the grow house right now, even though I understand that's something that Greenway would like to be submitting. So, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to support the motion. I wanted you to understand that. I really feel like the policy work that we need to do, which is going to come out of staff and the investigation that they're doing, for us to be very clear and clean about our policy, and based on what you just said, is exactly the reason I want to do that, because we are moving forward. We want to be a community that does this right and does it well.
What is not clear and unclean about even Rotkin's minor change, which is to allow Greenway and Ken Sampson's club the right to grow the marijuana on their premises? It's not unclean, unless you think marijuana is unclean, unless you think this whole practice is unclean. And really, that is the perhaps underlying mentality that Councilmember Robinson is really relying on. And it's frankly, it's a despicable and discredited position, which has resulted in massive and increasing number of arrests every year of people for marijuana possession, cultivation, sales, and use. And that's something people have to understand, that nationally the number of people arrested for marijuana is going up. And again, had I time enough and resources enough and energy enough, I'd be getting you figures on marijuana arrests in Santa Cruz. I don't know if they're going up, they're going down, they're saying they're staying stable, but if you look in the papers, you see the deputies raiding and the DEA raiding, small drug busts all over the place for marijuana, which, well, I want to take that last back. I don't have the statistics, so if anybody actually has an interest in this project, and I know at one time we had people in the studio who were interested in fighting this drug war hysteria that we have in Santa Cruz, which is now coming back to haunt us. This city council meeting is a farce. There is no health, safety, and welfare emergency that is required to suspend the process, which is already a very difficult one, to open a dispensary. And Robinson's claim that making a, you know, adding a grow room to the existing dispensaries is unclean and unclear is also equally preposterous, I mean, and unexplained. What it really means is that she wants to slice off as much of the marijuana legalization movement as she can, locally. That's the objective, to put as much grit in the wheels of this attempt to actually rationalize an insane policy that's been going on for decades. That's what the city council is doing, and people should see it. If they did, and if they spoke up about it, council members could not continue to maintain these positions. By the way, if you want to call city council members and tell them what you think of this crap, although they're on vacation, you can reach their answering machines. It's 420-5020. 420-5020 is the city council's 24-hour voicemail line.
And I want to just, I prefer to stay really clean with the moratorium as we're presenting it. I'd be willing to chop a month off of that 7 months because it is, it's an imposition for anyone that's hoping to do either a medical marijuana dispensary or a production. But because I think it can be done with staff time, that's why I asked the question I asked about how much time they really need. They don't necessarily need that 10 months. But I don't want to change who, what, where in terms of who can have an exemption. That's my own feeling.
Yeah.
Okay, other comments?
Yes, question. Because we need six votes, you have a lot of power here. This is what comes out of this. Let's be clear about that. I just wonder whether I'm going to make a brief argument. If you don't buy it, you won't, and we'll move on. And I'll change it because I want to have something succeed here rather than nothing.
Yeah.
I'm quite persuaded that there is, in fact, going to be a problem with people who need, and I'm talking about serious patients who need medical marijuana at these two facilities, that given the crisis that's now going on, and I've been reading about this in a couple of different publications and also heard from people directly, but I've read enough about it to understand it, that they're going to have some problems getting enough product to sell people, and the end result is going to be prices going to shoot up, and then these people who are many terminal patients and people with serious medical problems are going to have a hard time affording the medicine that they need. And so that's the compassionate issue that, in effect, you know, directed me towards wanting to say, one, some place that they can get it, they can actually grow their own product, because otherwise they're going to be stuck at the mercy of the market. And as was pointed out, I think Lisa was the one that pointed it out, you know, right now we're in a bidding war against LA, which has, you know, got a huge demand for this product, and they're going to be in a situation, I think, where they're going to be forced to raise their prices on people that can hardly afford to pay them. So that was the logic that was driving me here. And so I really would ask you to consider whether, again, one or at the most two additional growing facilities subject to the same limitations, distance from schools, all of the other kinds of issues that we need to address here. And in fact, the staff had asked me, should it be on existing site? I don't know if we want to limit it that much, but they certainly would be subject to, they can't plop themselves in the middle of it. They can't even apply for a special use permit. And that was the comments I was going to make after this motion, to have this thing be in the middle of a residential neighborhood or this, whatever the distance is right now from a school or everything else that we placed on the limits on the current facilities that we have out there now. So that's what's driving me here. I just don't want to have dispensaries that dispense something that the often low income, often senior terminal kind of patients can't afford is not much of a benefit to them on some level. So I'd ask you to think about that. Whatever your decision is going to bind the final outcome here.
I understand. Ryan and Don.
I guess on this.
This is Ryan Coonerty.
On the production house, I mean, one of my. If they abide by the guidelines, it's a special use permit. Does the council still have full discretion even if there's no basis? Five neighbors show up who just don't like it. Can we still say no even though they fit all the criteria of the current ordinance?
Well, it's like a use permit. It's not a popularity contest, but it would go to the Planning Commission, and it has the right to be appealed to the city council. So it would be due process. Like,
would they have a legal basis? Would the council have a legal basis on the basis of two neighbors in opposition?
Yeah, pretty broad discretion.
Well,
it's public welfare. It's
I mean, just like any normal use permit. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's difficulties, as we've pointed out, with the current ordinance that you may be forced to face if it came before you, but you have the discretion when you review it.
So what Coonerty is trying to do here is say, well, we're going to have to vote for a moratorium even on the grow houses, even for clubs we've already agreed to that are already open, because if two neighbors objected frivolously, they couldn't get their objections passed provided all the current law requirements were met. It's got to be, you know, and the, you know, the staff tells Coonerty, no, the council can always say you can't open this grow house. You can't do that. It doesn't, even if it fits all the requirements, we can still vote you down. It's within our discretion. So even if what Coonerty is saying is he wants the most reactionary members of the community to have a veto over a grow house in their community, a grow house in their neighborhood, even though there's no safety problem, no health problem. It's just they're uncomfortable with the idea. And the staff tells him, yes, city council does have a veto over that. So Coonerty will now try another tack to argue against this minor Rotkin amendment, which I remind you shuts down all applications for 6 or 7 months, and shuts down all grow houses for both applications for dispensaries and grow houses, but allows the two clubs that currently exist to establish grow houses in the very limited way if they can get a use permit through a special use permit hearing, which I remind everybody it took 5 years to find a landlord who would allow a club to open up. Actually, they found a landlord for the Pacific Coast Cooperative in 2004, but the city closed it down anyway, 2004, 2005. Until Lisa Molyneux was able to, you know, pull the right strings and grease the right wheels, and even then she had to get a variance. She couldn't fit it. It took many months to get this done. By that time, the staff could have worked out new rules and brought them to City Council in the fall if they really were a need for new rules. But there's no indication. There is a need for new rules. There's a need for more liberal rules. But what the staff wants is more conservative rules, it seems to be the case. And because even within the very, very restrictive rules, two clubs were able to put forward applications where they actually found landlords within the very circumscribed area where you're allowed to open up 600 feet from a school, 600 feet from here, 600 feet from there. And so it defeated the prohibitionist mentality that really was behind the medical marijuana law of 2000. So now this is really sort of the son of Godzilla coming back. They want to, and they have now successfully put a freeze on all clubs and dispensaries. Again, Rotkin could have, by his one vote, refused to go along with this because it requires such an overwhelming vote because it requires a real finding of health, safety and security. I mean, health, safety and welfare. And that is a pretty high standard, although for this council, apparently it's a pretty low standard because they don't make any findings at all about that are specific.
And I guess my general comment is, you know, I'm
sort of again.
More inclined to be with Lynn on this, and I appreciate what Lisa does in terms of the compassionate use, but if you compare the patients in the city of Santa Cruz who have access to, if you're living in Hollister, if you're living in Sacramento, if you're living in anywhere else in California, much less anywhere else in the country, and your access to medical marijuana is greater, you're in a much better position, and especially because we have people who have compassionate programs and go out of their way to help people, than virtually anywhere else. So it's not a perfect system, but can we operate in an imperfect system for 6 months until we come up with a system that works? And my last comment to the two current applicants, you know, I think in many ways you actually made the point, which is you said, you know, San Francisco got to a point where it's one for every 20,000 people. Right now we have two applicants. We have 58,000 people, so we have one for 26,000 people in the city of Santa Cruz. And again, my concern is, do we have enough for the residents of the city of Santa Cruz, not for the county of Santa Cruz, not for the region, not for our area, do we have enough for the citizens that we've said, and we have approximately the same ratio that they have in San Francisco.
And I mentioned before, this is a false statistic, because what's happening here is San Franciscans have access to 20 or 30 clubs. They can just go right across town. People here in Santa Cruz have access to two clubs, and it's just not the same at all. We have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, hello.
You want to talk on the air?
Yeah.
Go ahead. What's your name, caller?
Eduardo.
Eduardo.
Yeah.
Bienvenidos, Eduardo.
Bienvenido. Quiero poner una canción para todos los de Durango.
Es necesario hablar muy despacio porque mi español es muy, muy malo. You have to talk very slowly because my Spanish sucks.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry, man.
Yeah,
lo siento,
okay.
Señor.
Yeah.
But ¿qué quiere hacer? ¿Qué quiere decir? What would you like to tell us?
Yeah, the music, for speak Spanish, the Mexican.
Okay, can you say that again? What exactly?
No speak Spanish, is that the music?
¿Qué?
No speak Spanish, the music?
¿Tú dices que tú quieres música aquí o no?
Sí.
Este programa, the caller is looking for some music. Este programa es discusión political de cosas de derechos humanos. Poco de música y a las ocho, at 8 o'clock, we have another show, en otro programa de El Hombre Tío Dennis, Uncle Dennis, will be coming on with a programa se llama From the Cream to the Dregs, which hay más música, pero es música de los es de the 1960s and 1970s, no sé cómo se dice en español, and no hay mucho música hispánica, pero pues, yo pienso que más tarde en la noche es música hispánica. Later at night, there's Spanish music.
All right. All right, thank you.
Hey, thank you, señor. Pregunta para usted.
Mm-hmm.
¿Hay un problema con ellos que hablan español para obtener marihuana para cosas medicales en Santa Cruz? Is it hard for people who speak Spanish to obtain medical marijuana? ¿Sabes? Do you know?
No.
¿Tú no sabes?
No.
Entonces, gracias, señor.
Okay, thank you.
De nada. And he doesn't know, so we move on to back to the city council's really pro forma discussion of the medical marijuana issue. And my apologies to all those who speak Spanish. I wish I could be translating this into Spanish, but I obviously have a very limited capacity to do that, particularly with complicated issues. We have a caller, though. Hi there, caller. You're on Free Radio.
Música en español es los días lunes y martes por la noche.
Ajá.
Adiós.
Gracias. So that's Mondays and Tuesdays, I believe, lunes y martes, for Spanish music in the at night, for those who are interested and those who speak English and want to listen to some Spanish music, too. There are many, of course, Spanish-language music stations, a number of them anyway, FM stations in the, I think some AM stations, too, in the area. And we do have a number of Spanish-language broadcasters. In fact, vamos a ver... I think every day at, I think we have, do we not have the Informativo Pacifica is Información en Español cada día a las cinco y media. Each day at 5:30, there is news in Spanish for those who are interested. And I am very interested. Yo quiero saber, yo quiero aprender, I want to learn. Si hay problemas, if there are problems with the para obtener marihuana, para cosas medicales, o para recreación, para ellos que hablan español aquí, para ellos que no tienen mucho dinero, for those who are Spanish-speaking and don't have much money. So do give a call, 427-427-3772, 427-3772, give a call. And let's hear some more from the... useless Santa Cruz City Council.
For the residents of San Francisco.
This
so,
is Coonerty. And Coonerty, I want to remind you, is making the false, giving us the false stat that since there are 30 or more clubs in San Francisco, I think there are more than that, and that works out to one per 22, 3,000 people, that because there are two in Santa Cruz, and Santa Cruz's population is only 55,000, that's enough. Of course, since the clubs also service other areas, other people come to Santa Cruz for these two clubs, it obviously puts a special burden on them and doesn't serve the people in Santa Cruz sufficiently. I mean, if they only serve people in Santa Cruz, you might try to make that argument, but I still think you'd be stuck with the reality that in San Francisco, even though, you know, it is true, if you average it out, it's one per 23,000 perhaps, 25,000 people, one club per 25,000 people. There are numerous clubs and options you can go to. And so you can go to various clubs to get a supply. Here in Santa Cruz, there are only two, and those are overburdened because people come from out of the area because we have equally benighted authorities with the kind of toxic mentality that is now currently moving the Santa Cruz City Council to shut down medical marijuana clubs or the possibility of new medical marijuana clubs. I know, they're just... studying the issue, right? Yeah. Okay. Moving on with this debate.
Yeah, that's why I'm okay with a moratorium until we look at this, because I think we really need to look at, drill down and say how many people in the city of Santa Cruz, and if someone in Watsonville or Scotts Valley or San Lorenzo Valley needs access to medical marijuana, I hope that those communities will provide facilities that they can get the medicines they need. I don't think Santa Cruz has to be the place for everyone in the region to go.
But practically, it is the place where people go when those other communities don't provide facilities, and that means that those who are here don't have, are not adequately served by the existing clubs. So Coonerty is full of shit, quite simply, in the most vernacular language. And it's, let me put it this way, his argument leaves something to be desired.
You know, I just had this is a more technical question. It's, you know, in reading the staff report a couple of weeks ago and then also this one, it talks about the extension being 10 months and 15 days. It's very explicit. So can we really make it less? It seems like we'd have to make it 10 months and 15 days and then just direct you to bring it back sooner, but I just wanted to clarify that.
The statute provides that there can be an extension for 10 months and 15 days. It also gives alternatives for 22 months and 15 days, but it is permissive that you may extend it, and the purpose of the statute is to not extend into perpetuity a moratorium, and so I believe that it would be consistent with the purpose of the law to scale it back.
Okay.
Notice that Don Lane, as usual, isn't going after the substance, which is where's the emergency, what's going to happen to people who need the supply, what's really happening here in terms of whether there's a real problem involved, but it's just, oh, can we do this according to the law? It's like he's, I don't know, it seems like sort of reassuring, like babble about a secondary subject that has nothing to do with the main topic, which is essentially cutting off people's access to herbal medication that many find useful and recreational marijuana that folks find, frankly, is far less deleterious than other kinds of recreational medication or drugs.
Well, just to count noses, I'm strongly in favor of continuing the moratorium as it's suggested here, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to change my motion. Save your speech until we're done. So the motion's going to be...
And here's Rotkin surrendering, although he doesn't have to surrender. His one vote could block this entire moratorium. Similarly with Tony Madrigal, similarly with Don Lane. None of them seemingly have the balls or the ovaries to do that. Although it doesn't take a lot of balls to say, you know, show me the emergency and we'll talk about it, but there's no emergency, which is pretty self-evident. At least no evidence is being presented.
Okay, a moratorium with this, I'll move it to 6 months, as was suggested, with a little more pressure on staff to get it done quicker, and make the findings as recommended by staff, and I believe that's the entire motion
and
necessary.
And refund
the money. If they decide to withdraw their thing, they'll get all their money back that they put into this process.
Nothing about the garage?
I've got the votes. You need 6 votes for this to happen, so there's no point in going up against 2 negative, now maybe 3 negative votes, mm-hmm. Going nowhere. I'm a realist.
No, he's a gutless person on this issue. He is willing to succumb to the broader mythology and hysteria without requiring that there be a minimum finding of health, safety, and welfare concerns. There's no such finding. There's the possibility such things might be found, but that has to be weighed against existing needs. And, I mean, what you might do is you might say, well, let's do a survey in the community of the needs, or let's talk about that issue. And if we find there isn't that much need and we find there is, there's really danger involved, then you can bring back the emergency moratorium. But there's no emergency. Therefore, Rotkin is allowing, is misstating the situation again. That's what really kind of ticks me off. He's saying that he can't do anything because he can't get the votes for his motion. All he needs is to vote himself against the main motion, and the moratorium fails. So apparently he wants the moratorium.
Okay, I'm going to second your motion. Okay, further discussion? You ready to vote, Tony? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Happy to vote.
Okay, so we have approved this recommendation in front of us then. Thank you for coming.
And that was that. That was Sanford City Council from about a month ago. recess in August for 6 weeks until the second week in September. Sorry about that. My mic was down. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, 101.1 in Santa Cruz. Esto es el nombre de este programa es Bathrobes Piers Broadsides. No sé cómo se puede hacer decirlo en las palabras en español, yo no sé, pero es mi programa, es en cosa de hablar de los derechos de humanos. It's all about human rights. I don't know how to say it in Spanish very well, and I'm sure as hell not going to be able to effectively do dual translation, but I'll try to get a few things in. And si hay alguien que habla en español mejor y quiere hablar de estos sujetos, de estas situaciones y las cosas que yo hablo, the things that I'm talking about. If you got things you want, if you want to call in, please don't be afraid. No tenga miedo para hablar en esta estación de estas cosas. Es importante para ¿cómo se dice? Su boca es importante. Your voice is important. So think about that. 427-3772 is the call-in number. And I've got a couple of things I wanted to bring up. Interesting article. Sacramento has been fighting the sleeping ban, its own sleeping ban. That's a city of hundreds of thousands of people. I think it's almost got 1 million people. I'm not sure what the actual population is. Loaves and Fishes and other organizations up there. SHOC, Sacramento Homelessness Organizing Committee, has been running protests in Sacramento for a so-called safe ground, which is like campgrounds, car parks, places where people can, tent cities, can find emergency shelter in the current emergency. It's similar to Santa Cruz, what Santa Cruz has been seeking, similar to what was set up in Ontario, California, Portland, Oregon, with Dignity Village, Tent City 4 up in Seattle, Camp Paradise back in 2001 here in Santa Cruz. And so we, or the Coral Street Open Air Shelter actually got set up in 1995 for a while, until it was closed down by Rotkin and Kennedy in the winter of 1995. And there's a, simultaneously, and I think the reason that the politicians are responding to this in Sacramento somewhat, is the Mark Maron, a famous and effective civil rights attorney who's won millions of dollars for people for police abuse and misconduct, bad strip searches and so forth, has filed a lawsuit in 2007, 2 years ago, to end police enforcement of these laws that criminalize homeless people and stop them from surviving, engaging in survival behavior like sleeping. Again, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere, or I should say nowhere are they allowed to sleep, period, and there is no shelter for them. So there is an interesting article in the Sacramento Bee, which is the big establishment paper there. I'm going to read some of it. Sacramento Task Force plans campground for up to 60 homeless, which is, of course, a drop in the bucket, but it's at least acknowledges the validity of the concept. City leaders, business owners, and homeless advocates have crafted a plan to create a legal safe ground where people without permanent housing could camp without police interference. A task force assembled by Mayor Kevin Johnson has drafted a report outlining a campground that would house up to 60 people and offer basic amenities such as running water and garbage pickup. The camp would be run by a governing board of homeless people with the help of a social worker or case manager and would have strict rules against drug and alcohol use and violence. And they also need a provision for a wet camp if it's going to work, but that's not provided for this. According to and a wet camp means a camp where you are allowed to drink, where you are allowed to use drugs, because these things are going to happen anyway, and you need to find ways to engage in harm reduction. But this is, you know, the big fetish of the moment is drug-free and all that sort of thing. According to an early version of the plan completed last week and obtained by the Bee, Sacramento Bee, the program would serve as a temporary step toward permanent housing for chronically homeless people. Residents would stay for a maximum of 18 months. Advocates have already begun raising money toward the effort, which will be funded with a combination of private and public funds and targeting possible areas of the city where the campground might be established. Johnson hopes that the Stepping Stone Campground, which would require approval from the City Council, will be ready to open by the time winter shelters shut their doors in the spring, said spokesman Joaquin McPeak. That target date will mark about a year after more than 100 homeless campers were forced to leave their controversial tent city on property owned by the Sacramento Municipal Utility District north of downtown. Since then, city and community leaders have been working towards finding permanent housing for the group while studying the possibilities of a legal campground. Among the leaders of the effort is John Krantz, a former Tent City resident who has been sleeping outside for the past 6 years. Krantz, 55, said homeless men and women unable or unwilling to find permanent housing have been camping in various locations around the county, dodging police since the Tent City's demise. This is a necessity, he said, of the safe ground concept. It makes no sense to have people continuing to sleep on the street, creating all the problems that go with that. We need to bring substance to chaos. Joan Burke of Loaves and Fishes, which offers a variety of daytime services to homeless people at its complex on North C Street, said she is optimistic that the project will go forward despite some strong disagreements about certain details. Residents and business owners in the city's River District along Richards Boulevard and close to Loaves and Fishes object to placing the campground in their neighborhood, Burke said. The not-in-my-backyard sentiment is pretty evident in this group, she said, similar to the Santa Cruz objection to safe sleeping zones in 2000, although that was a much less well-thought-out proposal that was passed after extensive pressure by homeless activists instead of the modifications that would really have been sensible. It was a last-minute proposal that was eventually defeated by Councilmember Catherine Byers, who turned coat in the summer of 2000, and is now again on the City Council doing absolutely nothing to establish adequate shelter for homeless people in Santa Cruz. It's about 80% better, said Joseph Taylor, lives in a street that homeless people navigate on their way to and from Loaves and Fishes, said his neighborhood has become less noisy and disruptive since the dissolution of the Tent City. In other words, you can't hear their screams, so things are definitely better. Yeah. It's about 80% better, said Taylor, who is not a member of the task force, but has been a strong voice on the issue. These folks are not going to go away, so I support the idea of having some place for them, he said. But I don't want it here. Our neighborhood has more than its share of disruptions. The report does not identify potential property for the campground, but Burke and others said that the search is underway for a place that would have minimal impact on businesses and neighborhoods. One other major point of disagreement about the safe ground, Burke said, involves security services. Some members of the task force think the campground should be policed by a private security force around the clock, which would cost around $218,000 a year. Burke and others believe the site could be policed by city law enforcement. Without private security, the total cost would be about $170,000 annually. You know, do they need this kind of security if it were, let's say, an apartment building or if it were an ordinary campground? I kind of think this is another example of demonizing homeless people, but that's just my reaction. Continuing to read this story about Sacramento Tent City, if it is sited correctly in a non-residential area and if it is well managed, we won't have any serious issues, Burke said. The report identifies various possible funding sources for the project, including nominal rent paid by residents, donations from the business community and private individuals, and city and county dollars. On Monday, California Emergency Food Link announced that it has donated $8,500 towards grading of lots, fencing, and other needs of the project. We want this to be a national model and a success story, Burke said, adding the task force studied legal homeless campgrounds in other cities before putting together its report. We want to establish a place where people can come and be safe and free and have the tools to get their lives in order. And for more information, you can go to safegroundsac.org, www.safegroundsac.org. That's the skin of the story in the Sacramento Bee. And there's a number of comments, actually 142 comments. Apparently it's a controversial subject. My friend Greg died homeless in Sacramento, and I'm glad to see that advocates are working hard to make things better for people there. Another person writes, they should only be allowed to stay there if they offer to do volunteer work. Another one writes, about time some real thought is put into this. I like the ideal. The estimated cost is too high, and they should only be allowed to stay there if they do volunteer work. And we have the standard response here. Again, I must say survival of the fittest. Handouts weaken the moral backbones of mankind. This is coming from someone whose father is homeless at this moment, living in Wilmington, California. My dad doesn't drink or do drugs. He did not plan for his future, and now he sleeps in a broken-down van in a junkyard. You reap what you sow. So if it's if my dad has to do it, everybody does. And there's a whole bunch of comments. I would encourage people to check it out, and I will probably be talking more about this. The point being, though, that large protests in Sacramento and a lawsuit raise the issue to a visible area. And, of course, the amount of money coming in from the federal government for their bogus 10-year plans to end homelessness, which is really a 10-year plan to pay consultants to do studies on homelessness, again, has put this in a position where at least they're making token efforts. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
I have a question for you.
Hi, what's your name, caller?
Renee.
Hey, Renee.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm okay. How about yourself?
Not bad. I have a strange question for you.
No problem.
So it shows that there is an option for iTunes to listen to the radio station through.
Oh, gee, you know, this is the kind of question you're dealing with a complete idiot, technically. What you can do, and what others can do who have similar questions about, like, how do you have a problem listening online, or you want more information about the technical aspects of the station, give a call to the voicemail line, which is, do you have a pencil?
I will in a second. Yes, I do.
Okie doke. It's 427-4523, 427-4523, and leave your message there asking, you know, and you'll probably get a response within a day.
Cool.
Hey, thank you.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And, yeah, phone lines are open, 427-3772. And I was just reading an article from the Sacramento Bee about the lawsuit and protests are producing at least a tentative plan for 60 people to find shelter in a city where probably 10 or 15 times that number need to have emergency shelter. And, of course, if it were a fire, if these were people losing their homes, you know, Red Cross would be there in a minute. Red Cross is not interested in this crisis. It's more important to spend money, apparently, drone bombing people in Pakistan, increasing the occupying force in Afghanistan, maintaining, what is it? 10 to 14 billion a month on foreign wars. So it's a weird society we live in. It will continue to look even more distorted. They'll be taking away your home. Next is, of course, to pay for the bonuses for the CEOs. You know, I mean, that's what they want to do. They want to balance out. What they am I talking about? I'm talking about the folks. It's almost reached a sort of an impersonal kind of mechanism. The people who benefit, and those who simply go along with the existing system that we're in right now, we can't expect folks who are on the gravy train to want to jump off it, or folks who are afraid of losing what they have, even if it's far more than what the rest of the community has, to change it. It really falls to the rest of the community to make these changes. And the problem, of course, is that we are really badly out-propagandized. Whether it's on health care or the war, or whether homeless people deserve, need, and it's actually better for everybody else for there to be basic services available. You've got the steady stream of propaganda that says no, no. So another aspect of the Sacramento situation was brought to my attention with an email from Joan Burke of Loaves and Fishes, who's quoted in this article. Loaves and Fishes is one of the organizations that it provides meals for homeless people. It provides some services. It was a supporter and advocate as well for Safe Ground and was part of the protest. I was a critic of what they did in the two protests because they had a one day protest. They stayed overnight one night, and then they went home instead of setting up a tent city and sticking with it. But, you know, they're adopting their own strategies, which at least are having some results. One of the results seems to be, well, here's a letter from Joan Burke. "We're continuing to work towards establishing safe ground in Sacramento. It is heartbreaking to see scores of homeless campers coming to Loaves and Fishes each morning, carrying all their meager belongings with them and telling us of being rousted from spot after spot. The ongoing fear of being discovered takes a heavy toll on each of them. It is remarkable that even in such a stressful situation, they look after each other. We know we must act quickly to help them find safe ground. Mayor Kevin Johnson visited our safe ground campers twice last week at their hidden camp in a gully behind a storage building for 2 hours on Monday night, and then he rolled out his sleeping bag and stayed overnight on Wednesday night. Morning anchor Natalie Bomke of Fox 40 News accompanied him throughout, and you can see her coverage on Fox 40 News website." Maybe I can play it. I'll try and play that if there's a sound bite to it. "It is worth stating that if the mayor just wanted a photo op, he could have done that in 20 minutes. Instead, he spent more than 10 hours. He was genuinely interested in each camper's personal situation and what they had to say. Mayor Johnson was then interviewed on CNN discussing Safe Ground last Friday. He is eloquent about the camper's hospitality, dignity, and community, and about what Safe Ground is." And I may be playing some of that shortly. "We thank Mayor Johnson for his compassion and his commitment for ending homelessness in Sacramento." I'm not so overwhelmed, but, you know, that's the first I've heard in 30 years of a mayor sleeping outside with homeless people throughout the night. And that is, you know, something to note. I mean, it is true. It's a gesture. He goes back to his, you know, fancy house. But he did it, at least. Let's take a brief musical break here. And I will be back with maybe some of these. We can actually hear the mayor pontificating on the subject. And maybe saying something worth listening to. Who knows?
For Frying Pan Jack, who's alive, and the oldest of the old out there in Albany, Oregon. Frying Pan Jack settled out off of the trains, the Great Tramp. He got scared. He always told me if I get afraid to walk into a railroad yard, a makeup yard, it'll be time to quit. He used to carry a spike ball handle in his bindle, his bedroll, balloon, he called it, to fend off the ne'er-do-wells, but you know, the way it's gotten to be on the skids now, young, mean drunks and drug money. And so they prey off the old poor down under the railroad bridges. And so they tend to settle out and stay in one place where they feel safe. You see, he feels safe in this bar over in Albany, Oregon. If you want to find Frying Pan Jack, that's where you look for him. We shared a camp down there in Oroville at the foot of the Feather River Canyon coming out of Keddy on the Western Pacific. Keddy, up at the top of the canyon, still has a wooden water tower. It's never been torn down and you can camp under it. Anybody ever been there? Up in the High Sierra? Well, it's beautiful. Jack and I were in that camp. That's where he said to me, you know, he'd been tramping since 1927. He said, I told myself in 27, if I cannot dictate the conditions of my labor, I will henceforth cease to work. You don't have to go to college to figure these things out, no, sir. He said, I learned when I was young that the only true life I have is the life of my brain. But if it's true, the only real life I have is the life of my brain, what sense does it make to hand that brain to somebody for 8 hours a day for their particular use on the presumption that at the end of the day they will give it back in an unmutilated condition? Fat chance. So he built that big Montana bedroll, started piping the stem, panhandling, you know, head full of words and songs. He didn't write songs and poems. He found them and scattered them abroad for people like me to find and put to work again. He was old enough to remember the sway rods under the boxcars, riding the rods. Frightpan Jack, the two bums. The bum on the rods is hunted down as an enemy of mankind. The other is driven around to his club as fetid, wined, and dined. And they who curse the bum on the rods as the essence of all that's bad will greet the other with a winning smile and extend the hand so glad. The bum on the rods is a social flea who gets an occasional bite. The bum on the plush is a social leech, blood-sucking day and night. The bum on the rods has a load so light that his weight we scarcely feel. But it takes the labor of dozens of folks to furnish the other a meal. As long as we sanction the bum on the plush, the other will always be there. But rid ourselves of the bum on the plush and the other will disappear. Then make an intelligent, organized kick. Get rid of the wasted crush. Don't worry about the bum on the rods. Get rid of the bum on the plush.
And that was Utah Phillips, the bum on the rod. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, and now I'm going to play for you the Mayor Kevin Johnson from the CNN video where he talks about his sympathies with homeless people. We'll see. You be the judge.
Tell me, Mayor, can you really call a tent city a viable short-term option for people?
Well, I think our ultimate goal in Sacramento is permanent housing. We want to be a model city when it comes to dealing with our homeless population. However, there's always going to be a small group of people who do not want to go into shelters or permanent housing. And we as a city have an obligation to make sure that no one lives in third world conditions. There's a group of people right now that are living illegally along the river. And a viable option perhaps can be is something we call safe ground, where it's temporary housing, that people who stay there will be there for a period of time. And then secondly, it's about empowering them, us understanding what their issues are and getting them into permanent housing, which is the ultimate solution.
And tell me what you learned. Did anything surprise you as you mingled with folks there? And also, you know, a lot of people stereotype homeless people. Oh, they're Vietnam vets or they're people with drug issues, alcohol issues. And I understand there was quite a diversity of people in this tent city.
Kyra, you're exactly right. There's a new face of homelessness. There's the people that you talked about there, but there's people that have families and lost their job and now lost their home and are just down on their luck. So it's a new face of homelessness, number one. What I learned, though, is that these people living along the river illegally, they have more of a sense of community than most American families. They make sure that they look after each other. They want to make sure that their grounds are governed properly. They're clean. They're sanitized to the best that they can do. And what touched me more than anything is that they took their food stamps, went to the grocery store, and bought groceries where they were able to cook a hamburger, buns, ketchup, Arizona iced tea to feed me when I was out there that particular night, and that was really heartwarming.
Okay, that just totally made my heart sink. Yeah. My producer actually told me that right before we came up here, and I wanted to ask you if indeed that really did happen. Well, you know, they're looking to you for help. I mean, you just realize that these are good people who obviously want to do something within this bad economy, so can they count on you? I mean, there you were with them. I mean, you've talked about using stimulus money to modernize shelters. Do you think that's truly a good investment? Because a lot of people would say, no, take that stimulus money and put it into infrastructure that's going to create jobs immediately.
Well, I think when we think about the stimulus, and the Obama administration has shifted a focus from spending dollars on just shelters going toward permanent housing. So our ultimate goal is permanent housing. But I want those people who live along the river in Sacramento to know that the mayor of the city of Sacramento is going to be a huge advocate for their needs. My campaign slogan was a city that works with for everyone. And that was really with the homeless population in mind. And certainly this has been a dirty little secret that our city has not wanted to talk about. We've kind of swept under the rug. It's existed for at least 10 years or longer. And I think we have an excellent opportunity to win this war on homelessness. The people out there, they want dignity. They want respect. They want nothing more than the rest of Americans want. And I think they're certainly entitled to that.
And that was Mayor Kevin Johnson of Sacramento on a CNN clip. You can Google for it by going to by Mayor Kevin Johnson.
Jimmy Wales joins us via...
Whoops, I'll wait on that one. Yeah, just go to Kevin Johnson. Just Google for Kevin Mayor Kevin Johnson, Sacramento, homeless. You'll probably find that clip. Here's another bit from the Sacramento situation. This is Fox 40 News, the homeless solution. I'm not normally a big fan of Fox, but let's see how they sound.
Lee Bomke has been following the story and has the exclusive video for us.
And we believe that this will be the model, some sort of area like this, a safe ground where these rules are in effect, that the mayor will come to a conclusion on.
Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson publicly supporting a city-sanctioned piece of land that would house the homeless after spending... several hours overnight exclusively with Fox 40 and the people who would benefit.
Those folks have more community than most of all of us. It was a heart-wrenching experience, and it made me even that much more committed to fight for their cause.
Fighting for what could look a lot like this, Dignity Village, an experiment in Portland that's working.
It's a little bit choppy, but stay with us. I think we'll hear more. The pictures of Dignity Village are being shown. You can get this by going. Fox 40 News, Homeless Solution.
A little over 1 acre of land, capped at 60 residents, and leased for $2,200 a month from the city by its tenants. No drugs, no alcohol, and no violence. Those are the rules. Nearly 80% of the homeless here find work and move out within 6 months. Over 800 people have been helped since its inception in 2001.
We found a clear area. We're going to kind of pick around to see if there's any rocks. This is the type of thing you want to avoid right here.
In Sacramento, more than 1,200 people and growing on the streets who can't get into a shelter.
I tell them I'm a homeless person right now. I'm down on my luck. They go, oh, we'll call you. Don't call us. We'll call you. And that's it.
David has heard that line over and over again. The father of two with a college education has been homeless for 7 months. We followed him to and from a possible lead.
I told her I'm looking for a job. I'm qualified to do dishwashing, mopping the floor. She goes, where do you live at? And I said, I'm homeless. You know, what do I say? You know, I got a house. I got a place to live. I can't say that. That's a lie. So I told her that. She goes, well, I don't think they're hiring right now.
A solution is coming.
If I can't do all that I possibly can do to fight for their rights, then I wouldn't be doing my part.
Sacramento is expected to receive at least $5 million in federal money along with some private donations to address the homelessness problem. City Council must approve the final plan, and the mayor's hoping it'll be ready when the winter shelter closes next spring. Okay.
And that again was Fox News, Fox 40 News, Sacramento, the homeless solution if you want to Google for it and hear it again. It's interesting, you know, $5 million coming. Dignity Village runs on $2,200 a month. For 60 people, 1,200 homeless in Sacramento. I'm sure that's the real undercount. It's more like probably 12,000 in Sacramento. And I don't know the exact figures myself. But if you consider, if you actually expand the Dignity Village cost of 2,200, you could actually lodge 600 for 22,000. You could lodge 6,000 for 220,000. So by a fraction of all of that money coming in could actually address the homeless problem in Sacramento. And we found by talking to Mike Rhodes of Fresno that the mayor of Fresno actually has refused to spend the homeless money there. They simply don't want to deal with the issue. They want to prefer it doesn't exist because to acknowledge it would mean to have to take responsibility for it, to have to provide basic human rights for people. We're going to take a musical break, and I'll be right back. You're listening to Bathrob Spears Broadsides. My name is Robert Norris. We're talking about Santa Cruz homelessness, the right of people to be treated like human beings, to be able to sleep legally at night anywhere, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere. Upcoming protest on Saturday at noon in front of Lulu Carpenter's, one of the four businesses that set up that assign declarations that declare that if two homeless musicians fall asleep downtown, they will go to jail. That injunction has been passed, hasn't been repudiated by the businesses in question. Those four businesses, by the way, are Bunny Shoes, Borders Bookstore, Palomar Hotel, and Lulu Carpenter's. Let's take a brief musical break, and I'll be right back.
If I had a dollar and if I had a quarter, I would buy for you a bottle of the very best malt liquor. A big old 40-ouncer with a note that needs an answer. Look me in the eye and tell me how can you say no to love. We'll move out on the highway and see the whole world my way. Eat out of the dumpsters out behind the health food stores. We'll eat lots of sprouts and berries that are just a little scary. Sleep beneath the bridges on the freeway of dreams. My karma is too good for you to worry about the crazies. I love everybody and there's nothing that I own. And all of the axe murderers who like to hitchhikers will take us where we're going and then just leave us alone. Has suffered from expansion so many times he can no longer find his way around. Say goodbye to the high life and say hello to my life. Look me in the eye and tell me how can you say no to love. Well, if I had a dollar and if I had a quarter, I would buy for you a bottle of the very best malt liquor.
And that was a dollar and a quarter with Danny Dollinger. A couple of other things I was intending to pass on. Portland has had some interesting, Portland, Oregon, where you heard Portland, Oregon's Dignity Village referred to. This was a village created by homeless people who essentially began after a court decision, a local court decision, the Wicks decision back in 2000, found the city's law against sleeping, the sleeping ban, illegal or unconstitutional. And so they began sleeping in a park until the police rousted them, and they picked up all their shopping carts and they moved to another park and they were rousted again. They moved under the Burnside Bridge and they moved again. Finally, the city got so tired of this embarrassing shopping cart parade that they gave them a piece of property, let them rent it out in the outskirts of town where they are currently lodged, only 60 people though, and there are, of course, hundreds more homeless in Portland, Oregon, and still fighting the fight. But that was an example of how you can get something if you demand it and you don't go away. And Santa Cruz, I think the same situation is possible. That's why I'm encouraging people to bring forward their ideas about a tent city, which is the most obvious and cost-effective solution to at least emergency shelter needs. People are sleeping anyway. They might as well sleep together in groups. Probably smaller tent city groups in different places in the city would be better than one huge tent city. And they shouldn't have to wait until next spring. It's outrageous that the Sacramento mayor wants to wait until next spring to house 60 people in a tent city when obviously this would be done immediately. If there were a fire, they would set up a tent city. You know, you don't need 8 months to set up a tent city. It's posturing, and it's posturing only because there's existing lawsuits in Sacramento that threaten to make it legal for homeless people to sleep, yeah, anywhere and everywhere on public property, because they aren't allowed to sleep somewhere in reasonable, decent accommodations. And that is the same in Santa Cruz. In fact, it's been the case in San Diego, Los Angeles, Richmond, Palo Alto, Laguna Beach. Laws against homeless sleep at night have been declared criminal. That is, they've been declared unconstitutional, and it's illegal for police to enforce them. So instead, that doesn't mean that these cities necessarily found campgrounds for people, but there's a lot more pressure on them to do that, and particularly in Sacramento, this is the case. Similarly, lawsuits have been filed in Santa Monica and in Santa Barbara, and there's even talk about another lawsuit in Santa Cruz, although the earlier talk this summer seems to have devolved to a low murmur, but we'll see what happens with that. I believe there was the proposed car camp project that was going to be coming up that there's a website on it. If you go to Car Camp Santa Cruz, I believe you can, if you Google for that, and then for the name HERM, H-E-R-M, you'll find the website. I think that has been postponed either to another month or another year, but I'm still waiting for more information on that subject. Anyway, in Portland, there was a recent decision that I put out an email on. For those who are interested, by the way, in these topics, you can get on the HUF email list. HUF is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, group I belong to. Just give a call to the HUF line, 423-HUF, 423-4833. Leave me your number or your email address, and we'll send you the periodic updates on what's happening for the civil rights struggles around the country and also locally on these issues. But in Portland, as I was saying before, if I can find the right email here. Let's see. Portland judge. Here we go. Moves challenge to camping ban forward. A federal judge has dismissed some claims in a lawsuit challenging Portland's anti-camping ordinance, but allowed others to continue. The ruling by U.S. District Judge Ann Aiken means the case stays alive. Aiken, in ruling on the city's motion to dismiss the lawsuit, rejected claims that the ordinance violated the plaintiff's right to travel. This is the ordinance that says it's okay to arrest homeless people for sleeping at night. But allowed the claim that the ordinance, the sleeping ban in Portland, violated their constitutional right against cruel or unusual punishment, which, of course, was the core of the Jones decision back in 2006 in federal court in the Ninth District, which includes California, Oregon, and a bunch of states. The class lawsuit, action lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court in Portland by the Oregon Law Center, a nonprofit legal aid organization, on behalf of four homeless Portlanders and all others similarly situated. I'm now going to pause briefly while I let a monster into the studio. Come in, monster. So, continuing. The suit alleges that police officers have arbitrarily moved homeless people from place to place, excluded them from parks, and cited them for camping and trespassing, even though they can't obtain housing or adequate shelter in Portland. They also have been cited by police for gathering their belongings under tarps and in bike trailers. Punishing homeless people for sleeping outside is placing the burden of the lack of sufficient housing squarely on the shoulders of those who can do the least to remedy this problem, the suit says. The city argues that the ordinances are aimed at conduct and not the status of being homeless, but the judge ruled that the plaintiffs could present evidence that the city has criminalized being homeless, citing a U.S. Supreme Court decision that threw out a Los Angeles ordinance that made it a crime to be a drug addict. I guess the Robinson decision from the 60s. The judge also allowed the plaintiffs to present evidence that the city violated their right to equal protection of the law in singling out homeless people. The judge rejected a claim that the ordinance violated the plaintiff's right to travel to and around Portland, noting the city has no policy or program of excluding homeless people from certain areas. And there's a second article on this. A district judge has given the green light to a group of people experiencing homelessness to go forward with their class action lawsuit against the city of Portland's camping ordinance. In a decision reached Friday, Judge Ann Aiken ruled against the city in its effort to dismiss the grounds for the lawsuit, concluding in layman's terms that the suit, which seeks to declare the city's no camping ordinance unconstitutional, has the muster to go forward. The group of four homeless individuals say the city's enforcement of no camping and temporary structures ordinance criminalize the status of being homeless, singles out the homeless for disparate treatment, and prevents the homeless from traveling to or residing in the city of Portland. Three of the four plaintiffs have disabilities. Altogether, attorneys with the Oregon Law Center argued five reasons why the lawsuit should go forward. Judge Aiken supported two, that the ordinance has violated their right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment and their right to equal treatment under the law. The judge dismissed their claims to defend their rights to free travel, freedom of movement, and due process. Monica Garaki with the Oregon Law Center says the judge's ruling allows the case to proceed. The next step is to exchange information in the discovery process, Garaki says, which will mean several more months will pass before there is any further decision on the plaintiff's claims. The city prohibits camping or the construction of temporary structures on public property. However, those ordinances may be lifted by the city in extraordinary circumstances. In a recent report from the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, Oregon now leads the nation in the percentage of homeless people per capita. Oregon's homeless rate is 0.54%, according to HUD. Boy, I thought the national rate was 3%. I guess I'm behind the times, or HUD takes a much more optimistic view of things than I do. Well, we have about 5 minutes left in the show. Coming up next, of course, is Uncle Dennis with his infamous From the Cream to the Dregs. What do we got for us this evening, Dennis?
Well, this evening we're going to continue on with the playing music from Woodstock. This is the 40th anniversary of the music festival at Woodstock.
Groovy, man.
Yeah, it was pretty groovy. And so we'll start off with some Jimi Hendrix live from Woodstock 40 years ago and continue on. I do want to thank you for playing Danny Dolinger. Marvelous Earth First musician, great guy. And my only hope is that we could get him down here to Santa Cruz sometime.
That's a great
benefit
song.
For free radio.
That was the song...
Dollar and a Quarter.
Dollar and a Quarter, thanks.
I would buy for you a bottle of the very finest malt liquor.
And in fact, you'll be tasting some of that malt liquor by proxy. If you stay with Uncle Dennis, he has the new Rogue liquor coming up. Am I supposed to say the name of the liquor? Is it a secret?
Yeah. Double Dead Guy Ale.
Double Dead Guy Ale, boy. I suppose, we got to have a chocolate tasting show. That way I could really get into. But the liquor thing, I don't know. Anyway, I was actually going to be talking with Tad of Arcata, who has a lawsuit up there, or actually he's fighting his own case against, he was dragged away from a city council meeting or falsely arrested. But for some reason he has not been able to reach me on the phone, or I'm not sure what's happened. Maybe he'll call in on Sunday, when I'll be coming back, 9:30 to 1 is my morning show time on Sunday. If you have questions in the next few days, you can certainly bring them down to the protest at noon in front of Lulu Carpenter's, which is right at the head of the Santa Cruz Mall across from the main post office near the town clock. We'll be down there noon to 2 on Saturday, day after tomorrow. Let's see if I can wrap up anything else before I hit the road here. There's some debate on Santa Cruz Indie Media, or indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, around the protests that we've been doing downtown. A lot of it is essentially frivolous vituperation by people who want to attack those who want to end the sleeping ban, but don't want to go into, specific arguments. But there is some substantive argument coming out of that discussion. I had invited those critics to come on the air to talk, but they never do. They hide behind pseudonyms. They usually hide behind just pretty nasty commentary that hasn't got very much to do with the issue. But the issue is an important one. As you can see, even somebody as, politically juiced as Mayor Kevin Johnson has been forced to acknowledge that, you know, it's time to get some campgrounds going in Sacramento, or at least one token campground. That's about it for this edition of Bathrop's Pierce Broadsides. I did get an email from Tenderfoot Tim Rumford, who noted the DEA is next door up at his Coralita's home, kicking in doors and ruining lives on an early morning raid. And so apparently it can happen here, it is happening here, and it will continue to happen here until we stop it from happening here. So come on out, give a call to the Huff Line if you want to volunteer to at least deal with civil rights issues for poor and homeless people. Be happy to put you to work doing something. 423-4833. We have legal projects. We have illegal projects. We have semi-legal projects. Actually, we're pretty legal because we're a bunch of chicken shits here at Huff, or perhaps we're being prudent. I'm hard to say. Anyway, thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Stay tuned for the infamous Uncle Dennis, who will be woodstocking it up in another dive into nostalgia. Will we ever come up in 2009? That's the question. We'll see. Hopefully we will emerge, though not unscathed. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I will be back.
That's what we were afraid of.
That's what you're going to get, Uncle Dennis.
In the shadow of the military installation and police baton that threw up over my nation, there are fighters with a mission in the gridlock street, and they are working to ensure that people still can eat food, not bombs. We're going to take the streets and ransack the dumpsters. Food, not bombs. We're going to tie it to a table and feed your face with food, not bombs. Because those guns and nukes cause indigestion. Food, not bombs. We're going to fill up all the tummies in the human race. Some people try to put us down, but let me tell you about what's coming around. We got a gravy pot, a sweet potato stew. We got some bagels and some muffins and some salad too. When there's enough in the land to go all around, there ain't no justifying hunger when the sun goes down. And we are food, not bombs. We're going to take the streets and ransack the dumpsters. Food, not bombs. We're going to tie you to a table and feed your face with food, not bombs. Because those guns and nukes cause indigestion. Food, not bombs. We're going to fill up all the tummies in the human race. Now weed and seed hit my city yesterday, and the Salvation Army kitchen started to say, you need a picture ID or you won't get fed. We got to start keeping track of where the homeless people tread. We have to keep a close eye on the underclass, or someday they might decide to organize and whoop our ass. We are food, not bombs. We don't care who you are. You could be sleeping in a gutter, living in your car. You could be tight for rent and up against eviction, or be running for your ninth felony conviction. We will sit you down with a plate of food and watch a home-cooked meal elevate your mood. And if John D. Rockefeller himself walks up to our picnic line, we're gonna say, yo, what's up? Have a bowl of vegan soup, you crook. And next time, come on over to the kitchen and cook with food, not bombs. We're gonna take the streets and ransack the dumpsters. Food, not bombs. We're gonna tie it to a table and feed your face with food, not bombs. Cause those guns and nukes cause indigestion. Food, not bombs. We're gonna fill up all the tummies in the human race. Now we never serve genetically engineered foodstuffs. If we can help with that shit, it's weird. I'm talking cucumber mosaic virus out on the loose with some pretty fucking scary recombinant juice. That little bug is always itching to infect a host. Every gene pool on the planet's gonna be toast. I'm talking shellfish proteins and tomato sauce. And Monsanto Corporation playing planetary boss. They put your children's future in the Terminator seed, and they poison you with Roundup as if you were a weed. You got to fight the corporation every inch of the mile, from the factors of production to the produce aisle. Uproot the crops and burn the tractor. Monkey wrench the trash compactor. Shoplift in the supermarket chain. Every dollar that they profit is your people's pain. But every nickel that you save on your criminal spree is going to help rebuild your local mom and pop economy. Tear up their toxic parking lots and replace them with some unorganic garden plots to grow food.
Hey, that was pretty cool, Robert.
Yeah.
But we don't know who that was.
That was Skidmark Bob's fault.
Oh, well. All right, I'm Uncle Dennis. I'm hijacking this pirate ship for the next 3 hours, and We're going to wander back in time for about 40 years, almost to the day, actually. By August 20th, Woodstock was pretty much abandoned, and they were picking up the trash and tearing down the stage. But we started last week with our deja vu all over again for the Woodstock Music and Art Festival of 1969. And we're going to continue on tonight. Just wanted to let folks know, because I didn't do it last week, somehow I messed up. Uncle Dennis does mess up once in a while. I forgot to let folks know what the brew of the week was. Well, this week we're going to let you know. In fact, Robert already spilt the beans. What we have tonight is a big red bottle of something called Double Dead Guy Ale. And it's from the Rogue Brewery in Newport, Oregon. And, well, what the hell. Let's get it open so we can sit back and enjoy Woodstock all over again. That's pretty darn good. Yep, Double Dead Guy Ale, tonight's Brew of the Week, as we travel back in time to Bethel, New York, in the summer of 1969. I think the music festival started on the 16th of August and ended on the 19th. And anyway, here we go. We're going to actually not go to the initially to the Woodstock official CD, but we're going to start with Jimi Hendrix and his entire set, as I believe we're going to play the whole thing for you. Here it is, Jimi Hendrix live at Woodstock.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
I see that we meet again. Well. Dick, we'd like to get something straight. We got tired of experiencing every once in a while. We was blowing our minds too much. So we decided to change the whole thing around and call it Gypsy Sun and Rainbows. For short, it's nothing but a band of gypsies. We have Billy Cox playing bass and from Nashville, Tennessee. We have Larry Lee playing guitar over there, Yellen Lee. We got Juma playing congos over here, Juma. We have Granny Goose. Mitch Mitchell on drums. And we got Jerry Velez on congos too. You're truly on meat whistle. What, me worry? Okay, give us about a minute and a half to tune up, okay? Like, we only had about two rehearsals, so we're going to do nothing but primary rhythm for you. I have mine, thank you. I have mine, thank you very much. Take off.
song dedicated to maybe a soldier in the army singing about this old lady that he dreams about and hugging a machine gun instead. Or it could be a cat, maybe, trying to fall in love with a girl, maybe, but a little bit too scared. That's where the problems come from sometimes, isn't it? I mean, the cat really insecure a little bit, so they call girls groupies, and they call girls this. And they call passive people hippies, and blah, blah, woof, woof, on down the line. That's because they're fucking not in love, man. That's what's happening. That's the other half of a man as a woman, and we like to play a thing called Isabella. Don't you ever forget it. Y'all are hard-headed.